Welcome to the sixth seminar in the Work in Progress seminar series. It's my pleasure to introduce my colleague and friend, Dr. Mary Dharmanin, today, who'll be speaking about switching on, switching off, that's the title, Malta's IT policies and the gender digital divide.
Thank you, Peter. Just a little comment before we start. This is work in progress. Although I have already written the paper and presented it in another fora in an international conference last week, I will continue working on this project. The project is not complete. As a result of it not being complete and ready for final publication, and because I need to do more research, get access to more policy actors, more policy texts and discourses, etc., I am worried about the fact that I am broadcasting the work. As a result, I am going to censor some of my findings so far, because I need to continue to get access, and some of them might be too critical, as policy sociology usually is, to allow policy actors to continue to give me access. Now, those of you who are listening to this might wonder why I am saying it, but the reason is I think that all of us, researchers and students, and people in the education policy community need to appreciate that research isn't easy. There are all sorts of interests, the interests of the researchers and of the researched, and sometimes these are competing. Having said that, I hope that there is enough that I can say that would interest my audience, and I would definitely welcome any comments and even corrections that you would like to make. I might not have understood everything that is happening in the policy field. Just to talk a bit about the project, it is a project about a policy, so it is within what we would call critical policy sociology. And in critical policy sociology, we usually look at the policy context, we look at policy texts and discourses, but because we know that a policy text doesn't actually mean that this is the policy, and often you can have a text which is never implemented, this is what people who think that the text is the policy, or those who believe in a policy fidelity model, who think that if you have a national minimum curricula, for example, then you actually have it if you have the text. But those of us who are in the field know you could easily have a text and not have a curriculum. And I am not one who ascribes to the policy fidelity model. I look at the way a policy is practiced, experienced, implemented, and constantly negotiated and constructed. As a result, I do look at policy texts and I do look at policy discourses, which could occur in other fields now of late, more than in a text, especially on the web, through visuals, through sound bites, and through other means. So when I use the word discourse, I don't only mean words, of course, through press releases, photo opportunities, these are all becoming the sites where policy is now being made. And I look as well at policy actors. Actors might be institutional actors. For example, we could have an institutional actor like the EU, the supranational state, where certain prescriptions about the learning society, as you would find in the Lisbon strategy, would to a certain extent influence the local policy-making context. Policy actors could be individuals, they could be ministers, they could be press attachés, journalists, and they could be NGOs. In the case of Malta's IT policy, for example, the Computer Society of Malta is one such policy actor. So who are the actors? How are they relating in the creation of the policy field? I use the word field from Bourdieu, the idea that there are different fields and a field has an effect intersect and interrelates with other fields. Each field has a logic of practice in this sense, and one would have to understand how they are working. So when I talk about an education policy, of course, I have to think about a political policy, an economic policy, and an economic field, a journalistic field, if the media is now one of the sites of policy discourse. I then go on to discuss in particular the current digital divide. Is there a digital divide or not in Malta? And what do we mean by digital divide? I look then at the policy implementation. What is happening in schools in particular, in other educational sites, university, MCAST, lifelong learning centers, private educational sites, and also the Employment Training Corporation and anyone else who is involved with implementing the policy, such as the Ministry of Industry, Investment and Information Technology and other ministries. I review a bit the history of the policy going back to the 1980s, especially regarding education, because this is quite important, especially the shift in the policy away from the education field, the university and the division of education, towards industry, including the Ministry of Industry, Investment and IT. So what does this policy shift indicate? Has there been a diffusion or a dispersion of policy, or has there been a competition between these fields? And that is a question I ask. And I also finally consider, but this is not the end of the project. When I say finally, of course, there will be other things I need to think about as I go on working on this, the consequences of the policy. What do I think is going to happen, apart from what is already happening to different groups of young people, especially, but even of adults? All right, so that's just to give you a little overview. Now, I want to tell you something that I saw in the paper today, which is 6th April, for those of you who will be hearing me when this is broadcast. It was in the Times of Malta. There were two things I cut out, not on the same page. One was the need for vision of competitiveness, a foundation being set up to try and make Malta more competitive. So there is a sort of moral panic about the present economic situation and social situation. And then at the same time in the paper was a little announcement about an award being given to the Employment and Training Corporation by the Computer Society of Malta for the best IT project. So for me, these two little announcements in the paper, we can call them that, in a way, symbolize what is happening in this policy context at the moment. On the one hand, the policy context is telling us that there is, I think most actors would tell us, an economic crisis. And there is a suggestion that IT and IT education and an IT policy will solve the economic crisis. It will be a panacea for the problems. And secondly, at the same time, there are those people who are arguing, well, or related to this, a type of technological fetishism, it has been called, whereby they are saying that one of the people who proposes this is a well-known social theorist, Manuel Castells, and he has been very influential even with EU policy and especially with the Lisbon objectives, which Malta is, of course, very influenced by, trying to meet these objectives. The idea here is that if you do enough in IT, then you're going to be okay. And I'm not so sure about that, but you might want to have a look at this. The other thing that for me, this crystallizes the way this particular policy is going, that is that it's going through the newspapers. Where is the place for the policy discourse? Who is talking about the policy? First of all, anything new in policy appears in the paper. It isn't discussed in Parliament, it isn't discussed in other fora, it isn't discussed by the education policy policy community. It isn't discussed at the university. It appears in a press release or on a dedicated page in a newspaper. The Ministry of Industry, Investment and IT has pages on a number of newspapers. They appear as if they are independent, for example, finance or business or iTech is another one. And in fact, they are the pages belonging to that ministry. I don't know exactly how they are being financed, but certainly that's how the policy is circulated. And what happens when you have this with the media? The policy, first of all, there's a sort of a type of amnesia. We forget that there were any other discussions on the policy. Why? Because the journalists aren't going to be bothered to say, 3 years ago we said this, 4 years ago the forum, such and such a forum, said that. They just say what happened now. And they contribute to our forgetting of previous discussions. And apart from which, there is competition between the different newspapers to make sure they get the story and continue with the story. And then when they've actually run it, to stop it circulating. So what happens is there's a kind of circularity. It has been called in policy sociology with the policy. It just appears in this way and then it stops. So again, the media, I won't go on about this, but I just got you some examples. For example, here is a write-up in the Malta Today, a Sunday paper, only appears on Sunday, business and finance section, reporting on a seminar that I was present at, and some of you here were also present. It was run by the Employment and Training Corporation. The Minister for Family and Social Solidarity opened it. That seminar itself also, in a way, crystallizes some of the problems with the current policy. The seminar was about men and women, so it was about a gender issue and the ICT labor market. But in that seminar, there wasn't a formal representation from the Minister of Education, Youth and Employment, nor was there a formal representation from the Ministry of Industry, Investment and Information Technology, even though that is the main policy actor at the moment. So I mean, that signifies to me that there seems to be competition between the ministries rather than a unified vision here. And there are a number of other things that we could talk about. But this story appeared in every single paper, by the way. So this idea of the circularity, the story going the rounds, and then it becomes an uncontested, taken for granted part of our understanding. And the quote, the heading is, government's 100 million ICT investment bearing fruit. And I mean, this hasn't been contested. I don't know how one could contest it unless one had access to all the details of how, what the investment was in, etc., etc. But these type of sort of even aphoristic statements bearing fruit, you just remember, you keep coming across in this policy discourse. When you try and get some information, it's rather more difficult. You know, where has the investment been made, in what, and how do we know it's bearing fruit? It's a strange claim to have been made at that seminar, because the Minister for Family and Social Solidarity said there that only about 18% of Malta's working population were actually working in that industry. So it was not a very high percent. And in terms of women, it was even less. Of course, to get figures like that is very difficult, even though the Employment and Training Corporation just won the prize from the Computer Society of Malta. I don't know if in their wonderful program they can actually tell us who is doing what work in IT. I don't think it's that sophisticated to be able to tell us who's a programmer, who's a data collector. In fact, the category of people working in this field is subsumed under other services category, and you just can't tell who is who. I know the National Statistics Office is currently running a survey on people in the field to find out who is working where, etc. But unless, you know, they circulate before they do the survey their questionnaire to IT specialists and to social scientists to tell them, listen, with this question you will get this data, or you need to ask this question, or this will not be gender disaggregated unless you ask it in this way, we won't know. And I fear we won't get gender disaggregated data. Just as we don't get, for example, from education. I'll talk about later the division of education, but one of the things we know, the division of education has given all students access to an email account. They know how many students have an email account, but they don't know whether they are males or females. And this is in this wonderful technological age where they couldn't set up a program or a template that if someone applies for the account, you could actually tell whether they were male or female. So it really is a sort of a very good example of how for all the sort of technological fetishism, in fact, we aren't even be able to understand our society very well, despite having the tools. All right, so having given you this little preamble, I want to now go on to the main part of the paper. So the policy context, I think you already know that we have a number of problems apart from our deficit. I won't labour the point. But also we have a decline in industry, a rise in unemployment, and a very low overall employment rate. Only 54.4% of Maltese working age population are actually in employment. Which is very low. Labour force data from the Labour Force Survey give us other figures. For example, the female activity rate is only 36.7%. Compared to other EU countries, this is very low. The female employment rate, so that is actually working, not unemployed, as well, is 32.9%. Unemployment for females, 10.2% from Labour Force data. And 54% of unemployed females are aged between 15 and 24. These are young school leavers and they are not working. So we need to, of course, look at both the labour market, are there jobs, and at the young people, the matching, are they trained? And that is one big question. Only 2.5% of all females are self-employed. Again, the entrepreneur culture, low even amongst males in Malta, is even lower amongst females. So certainly, knowing that a lot of IT companies are within the self-employed category rather than big corporations, one could understand that one would want to promote these more. So that's a bit about the context. I think one should also say the obligations of EU membership is important because even before we joined, we were encouraged, of course, to raise the employment rate, and we are being encouraged even more now. So this comes definitely from the EU as much as from anywhere else, and part of the Lisbon strategy is to raise the female employment rate, for example, should be 60%. So you can imagine what a challenge this is going to be for us. Some things have been done in this policy by different institutional actors to try and prepare us originally for EU membership, and now that we're in, for satisfying the criteria. For example, the Employment and Training Corporation wrote in 2002 a gender equality action plan. One of its initiatives, of course, they have a number about equal access to employment, facilitating retention of employment of females and progression at work. But one of the initiatives was to set up a new knowledge center at the National Council of Women. And there they were offering IT training to employed and unemployed women and men. So they are definitely trying to do something. In the same year, 2002, they started running European computer driving license courses. And these that the take up of these courses has been very high. MCAST, the Malta College of Arts, Science and Technology, also offer these courses. However, one person told me that the cost at the moment, I think, is £130 for a course, and it is considered prohibitive and rather high. Some of the advanced courses lead to National Computer Centre UK qualification, and these are being run in conjunction with the Malta Information Technology Training Service, MITS. So certainly there are a lot of adult education initiatives. Apart from that, Knight Institute for Further Technical Education, this is for training people in technical skills and are part of the National Restructuring Programme. However, it is clear that it is the private sector which is actually providing most of the ICT training. And recent data from a survey on lifelong learning by the National Statistics Office shows what a high participation rate there is in the 54 adult education centres that were surveyed in 2003. The highest number of participants in these programmes fell in the under 20 years of age bracket. So it is quite an interesting discussion. Perhaps Professor Mayo will tell us, can we consider the under 20 adult? I mean, for me, it's a bit of a concern if these young people are going to these courses, well, what happened to them when they were at school? Because a lot of the courses are to catch up with things that a school leaver should actually have, a competency a school leaver should have. In fact, 32% of all the adults attending were within this age bracket, under 20. Computing was the most popular course offered by the private centres. 37.5 of the participants in these courses chose computing. And of these, 46% were female. So there is certainly a very high interest amongst females for training in basic ICT skills, usually not programming, but in other ICT. This number amounted to 1,194 females, and a further 1,314, here both men and women, attended other courses in computing run by government centres. So there is clearly a very high interest in getting basic ICT. Of the ones going to the government courses, 42% were female. 25% of all the females were under 20. So again, we're getting this message that the under 20-year-olds aren't getting enough education and training at school, which if I was the Minister of Education, maybe I would be rather worried about this. Other things that are being run, for example, the Department of Technology in Education, this is within the Division of Education, is definitely working within the Lisbon strategy in trying to get adults in literate, is the word they are still using, though most other people use fluency as the term, in ICT. For example, in conjunction with the Minister of Investment, Industry and Information Technology, they're now running a project after school hours called the My Web Project. And this is using the schools, the secondary schools, and therefore the computing labs that are available in secondary schools to train adults. Here, the MIIT minister is claiming that this is a community project, but anyone who knows where secondary schools are knows that not many of them are in a community. In fact, that's one of the problems with secondary schools. However, this is part of the big discourse of this community project. I don't have figures for how many people have actually attended yet. This adult education program is in fact financed by a grant from the EU. So again, here we see sort of the link between the supranational state and the local policy making. I have called it, and so have others elsewhere, the global in policy making. and it's part of the E-Europe Plus Action Plan. And according to the Director of Technology and Education, this is the way that schools contribute to their community, by offering ICT facilities which would otherwise have been idle. The return on investment in ICT in schools is therefore also boosted. In other words, they might be able to get some funds from the EU project to continue financing the labs in the schools, well, which is of course a very good idea. In the minister's two policy texts, when I say texts, they have appeared mainly on the web, and I don't think they have been circulated in other fora. They're very glossy, high pictures and other things, and of course to download them is very difficult because you use all your ink. So a little complaint there, but you know, these certainly haven't been circulated freely within the education policy community. But in these documents, this is the Hello IT text, which appears on the ministry's website, and also the national strategy for 2004 to 2006. He talks about these projects, the MyWeb and the MyWeb project, and he says the school will be used for adults after the tech savvy children go home. Of course, the question is how savvy, how knowledgeable, all right, savvy, the savoir faire of the children, how much it is, I'm not sure the minister knows, as I will show in a minute by my work on the results of the children's examinations, etc., and even take up of ICT and of computer studies. Because of course, one of the things to point out is we should make a distinction between having ICT fluency and being a computer studies specialist. And that is not appearing enough in this discourse and this distinction. And, you know, how are we going to prepare for these two categories, maybe even three categories, some theorists would argue, of people. All right, I'm going to leave the work on the media issue for the moment, because it's something I'll be working on in the future, and I already gave you some idea that this could be something interesting to look at. But what I want to talk about is some of the MIT ministers comments, because what we have seen in the last few years is what is known in policy sociology as a ministerialization of policy. The policy is made by the minister. The policy is not made by a policy community. Although there have been certain fora set up, councils, for example, the council meets three times a year. The council that meets three times a year has about 40 members. You can imagine how much each member in a council of 40 meeting three times a year can actually influence the policy. And so far, it is not clear exactly who is influencing it. When you see certain initiatives taken by the minister, such as the strategic partnerships, so-called, with big companies, and here apart from the EU, the supranational, we have to take into account the influence of the transnational companies like Microsoft, Oracle and HP. One would like to know whether the minister did speak to anyone in the policy community about these strategic policies. From the response of people in the industry and even the current case regarding fair competition, that is, if a minister makes a deal which in a sense is encouraging a monopolistic situation, then you might be going against the rules of fair trade. It does seem to me that there has been very much a ministerialization of policy. I say this also because it is very clear that the Division of Education knows about certain agreements, such as the one with Microsoft, which is to sell the software packages to students and teachers post hoc, after the decision has been taken. And then post hoc, they are asked to agree with it. And that allows them very little scope to be critical if they ever wanted to be, which is another question, of course. So this ministerialization of policy, what does the minister want to see? Well, he wants to see that there's going to be a growth in e-services, for example, e-government, e-health, e-learning, e-inclusion, and trust and security services. This is part of what his recent announcement of an E10 program. And this is meant to assist competitiveness. This is also part of an EU program. Interestingly here, where the minister gives a time frame, the EU would give a time frame for 2010, and the minister gives a time frame for 2007. And one wonders why there's this discrepancy. Of course, the general elections in Malta will not be, at least we don't think, that they'll be in 2010. So it could be that the minister's time frame is rather different. But one of the things that he said in a personal interview, and it's repeated in the policy text appearing on the web, the Hello IT policy and the National Strategy policy, is that he has an ambitious program to get 75% of Maltese houses connected to the internet. This was in when he was justifying his own promotion of specific computer brands and of public-private partnerships. He of course, mentioned his own advances in e-government, certain things you can get on the web now, even suggesting that soon we would have m-government, a memory stick, which we would all have, and on it would be all our medical data, our criminal record, I suppose. I'm not sure what else. I mean, I don't know how useful this is to have an m-stick if then your health centers are closed, but that's just a little aside. So, and even saying that soon we're going to have e-identification, make sure that we are not smugglers, drug dealers, etc., etc. This is going to make our life a lot better. Speaking at Momentum, a yearly IT conference organized by Microsoft, the same minister complained that fewer than one in three Maltese businesses offer support to their customers or use the internet for after-sales services. Of course, he would like to see much higher take-up. The real situation is worse than this. A day later, the National Statistics Office chief executive was to give a presentation on ITC usage in Maltese enterprise. The data is as yet unpublished, but Mr. Camilleri kindly sent me some of it. It showed that although 97% of all enterprises use ICT, only 7% use the internet to sell products to other enterprises. 9% receive payment online for internet sales, whilst the revenue generated by online orders is 13%. Not exactly what we were hoping for. In large firms, there seem to be a number of employees, 32%, who telework. Though what this exactly means, like if you do a little work at home on your computer, for example, I work at university, and if I put on my computer for an hour at home, is that considered telework? I'm not sure, unless you look at the question that was asked, what the meaning of the answer is, of course. So it doesn't look as if there's that much telework, just as I can see it at the moment. I need to look at this more. And only 46% of all the employed who were surveyed in this study use computers in the normal work routine. You might think 46% is quite a high number, but the question regarded, do you use the computer at least once a week? Now, you can imagine that, you know, if 46% are saying once a week, but if you say, do you use it once a day? And if you do you use it for most of your work? So again, I have to warn anyone reading this type of result to look carefully at the questions, what you're asking. And with that type of question, then an answer of 46%, yes, I use it once a week, really isn't, very high usage. A few weeks earlier, before this seminar at the inauguration of the first IT supermarket in Malta, Minister Gutt declared that his target for 2007, here it is that the 60% of all Maltese houses will be connected through broadband. This is the new target. 80% of all Maltese children will know how to use a computer. 75% of 16-year-olds will get an ECDL qualification. And the targets are within the remit of the 2004 National Strategy for IT. So he was repeating what's already in the document. Just a bit about the actors. I said that this is a new scenario. It has been extended to include businesses here and other policy actors such as NGOs, the Computer Society of Malta being one, because it regulates the ECDL certification and it has other functions. It collects labour market data. So it knows how many jobs there are in the field, who they are going to, etc. The president of the Computer Society of Malta was at the seminar run by the Employment and Training Corporation on women and men in the labour market. And when it was pointed out that a very small percentage of people working in the field are females, he not only was he not concerned, but he considered that there might already be a saturation with 15% females. This person is also the chief government information officer, so he's wearing two hats. He could be very instrumental in both roles in promoting more women in the sector, and at the moment I don't know if he will do this because he thinks that there might already be saturation and it isn't really necessary. This would not be what most researchers in the field think, where first of all they would think that this is a very, very low percent. Moreover, it is important for females, girls and women to be involved, not just in the question of access, which is just a minimum. Do I have access to ICT? Do I have basic skills to use it? But more than just access, to be empowered and to make generative use of technology for learning and innovation, so that they be involved in design and in other uses here. Is important, not just the basic ECDL, but in every aspect of IT. So to have the intellectual capability to be involved in technology for learning and for innovation means being rather better educated and having the opportunities to even determine how the whole field is going. Just to get back to the actors now, of course, other players, other actors include the liberalized telecommunications sector. One person here was a very important actor in the 80s, Professor Juanito Camilleri. As a professor here, through the university and through the Malta Council for Science and Technology, had been the main author of what was at that time the only national strategy on IT. This strategy is, which I'm just showing now, but the people on the listening can't see it. This strategy in the early 1990s, was very much shaped by the education policy community, whereas now the new strategy isn't. There's been the shift away from the education policy community. I would say there's even been an anti-academic. In one of these texts, the Minister of Education, or the person who wrote his text, I would be quite interested to know who that is, talks about the ivory tower of the university and of the learned, and let's move away. The discourse is very populist. It's appealing to the real people out there, as if the ones, you know, knowledge is not, we talk about a learning society, but we shouldn't really know anything. and we shouldn't have an academic discussion, and we shouldn't be informed by what research tells us. The real people out there, and even a lot of the pictures are showing girls and women, for example, they are there, very much females are there, but they are there in marketing the product. I couldn't use an overhead projector or PowerPoint here, and that perhaps is another point about our wonderful technological society. We're going to have all of these things, but then at the University of Malta, in an evening meeting, you cannot get an overhead projector, you cannot get a barco, you cannot use a laptop, and you cannot use a PowerPoint. And even something very basic, get a toilet, you can't, because they're not open. So I just had a little grouch, if you don't mind, on the radio. Maybe someone will hear it. Because this is one of the things that we need to.
We used PowerPoint last night.
You used PowerPoint?
It's a faculty one.
You brought it with you. Okay. But I mean, in other countries, in every single room in a university, you know, if I have an M stick, but I couldn't stick it anywhere. Basically. Yes. All right, I'll just. So the actors include, for example, Microsoft, this new strategic partnership, which is giving this software at greatly reduced price from £700, it is claimed, to 14 Malta pounds, a big reduction. Well, can we see the agreement? What is Malta giving Microsoft? Some people have suggested to me that Microsoft is going to use Malta as a case, a trialing for e-government software, and to see how it goes. If it doesn't work, well, what will happen to us? I don't know, because then that will be all our software. Certain things with the package, we know that the one for students and teachers has a part of it called Class Server. Class Server allows pupils and teachers to be online, and teachers' work to be reviewed by other people, by third parties, for example, parents, head teachers, and other people, which might seem to many attractive, that you are always available to your students, but I don't know how teachers feel about this, and the Malta Union of Teachers hasn't considered this is a form of regulation, a class server. This is what we've Foucault would call a panopticon, surveillance. You can see, has your teacher corrected the homework? When did you correct the homework? What did she say? Parents can see, etc., etc. We close the door to parents in schools, but we're going to open the 24-hour parent surveillance of teachers through Class Server. And no one has considered the implications of this. In the Division of Technology and Education, I was told that they had been asked to evaluate it. But what they mean by evaluation does not include taking a critical analytic perspective. It means seeing, does it work? Of course, we would hope, given it comes from Microsoft, it does work, though we're not sure, as I can see someone nodding in my audience here. So even that is, of course, a question. What is it we're getting? We know that Microsoft says that it's going to train teachers, but then to do it, it's going to use the labs of the Division of Education. Now, one of the things that various policy actors who I interviewed in the Division of Education told me that one of the main problems at the moment was access to labs. Do they have enough labs and PCs to train as many teachers as they wanted and as many parents as they wanted? And the answer was no. And do they have enough time? And the answer was also no. Now, if you're not going to have enough time to run your in-service courses on your educational software, on using ICT for education, and you're going to give up from this very precious time to do the training for Microsoft, I think you're going to have a problem. But again, you can see that once this deal has already been signed, there is not that much they can do, especially if the Minister of Education and Youth and Employment doesn't seem to be taking a very active role in this, apart from going to international meetings. So he hasn't made any declarations at all, hasn't made any comments, etc. All right, I'll leave the policy actors for the moment, just to before we we have our discussion to talk a bit about what's happening in education with the gender question. I said already that there's a difficulty by that we're not keeping enough gender disaggregated data. We do know from National Statistics Office research on information society indicators that women and men have a slightly different access to ICT, and especially at work. So that's quite important. For example, of all working males, 44.9% have a workplace-related address, compared to 23.4% of all working females. So this isn't to do with the proportion of men and women in employment. I have looked at within the working women, the rate is lower. All right. And that would make us sort of ask the question at work, who is given the main access, who is given the opportunity, who is given the training? And that's something I hope the new NSO survey will look into. It also tells us about youth and about training. It looks, in terms of basic computer training, there isn't much difference between males and females. 31% of all the males surveyed had basic computer training. The household study, 29.3% of all females had also had it. And within the younger group, 15 to 24, the rate for females was higher. More 68% of all females compared to 59% of all males had had basic training. But here one would ask, does it mean that girls going to basic training after school, because it's one of the questions, was due to the fact that they had had less opportunities during school? So you'd need to ask that. Regarding working, using internet for work at home, many more men, 52% of the men telework compared to 35% of females. Now I'll just talk a bit about computer studies, because here I've been talking about ICT and not computer studies. Now, with computer studies and the Division of Education, of course, the computer studies syllabus now of in the last few years is in conformity with the SEC syllabus. And people from the Division of Education have been instrumental in writing that syllabus. The SEC syllabus, as you know, has two papers. There doesn't seem to be much difference between males and females in which paper they choose. In females register for SEC, all the SEC exams, higher registration for females than males. However, there is a difference in subjects. More females than males are registering for subjects like accounting, biology, business studies, English literature, modern languages, whereas more males than females are registered for computer studies, technical design, graphical communication and technical design technology. So we can see, for example, for May 2004, with computer studies, 37% of all the candidates were female. When I say all the candidates, and I stress it, because it's to remind listeners that with the SEC results, we can separate the candidates into two groups. The first group would be all the candidates, including adults. That is not school leavers. And of course, it is interesting to know who is taking this paper, who is passing, etc. However, even more interesting, I think, for educational policy is to look only at the Form 5 candidates. That is the 16 plus cohort, because that really will tell us how well our education policy is working or not. So we do need to look at this. Now, when we look at this, we have a problem that we are not getting good data on our school populations. In fact, we're not getting any data on our school population, which means although we know how many children were born in 1988, who are the group who then sat in 2004, we don't know by the time they sit in 2004, are they the same amount who were born? Some of them unfortunately die, some of them emigrate. Some of the people who are 16 plus in 2004 are foreigners or returned migrants. So until till we get the populations of the form fives, this interpretation is of course not good enough, basically. I mean, it gives us an idea, inadequate, but we need to look at it anyway. And what do we know for 2004 about the 16-year-old cohort, the 1988 people? We know that 20% of the females born in 1988 and 34% of the males register for SEC computer studies. So there is quite a gap there in this group, 20 to 34. It is not one that I or anyone working in gender studies would be happy with. We would prefer to see more similar amounts of young people registering, males and females, especially considering that even though there are certain criteria that young people have to satisfy to do the course, I'll tell you in a minute, girls are doing as well as boys in those subjects. So what are these criteria? At the moment, in state secondary schools, to be able to do computer studies from Form 3, Form 4 and Form 5, you need to be amongst the highest achievers in maths, English and IT. Which means that students who aren't in any one of those will not be the preferred student. Of course, where there is an under-subscription, so if a school doesn't get the amount of students it wants, it might take other students who aren't doing very well in one of those subjects. And some schools have told me that this is what they do. And as a result, they have difficulties. For example, if they take some students who aren't doing very well in English, then when the students have to write out that part of the SEC, which is in English, describing certain things, of course, they don't do well. This is quite an important point because most researchers in the field, and even those who are looking at global differences and digital divides, remind us all the time that, of course, unless you are helping students overcome basic difficulties like with literacy, with numeracy, all right, you aren't going to get, so intellectual capability, you aren't going to get well-qualified people in this sector. And it doesn't make any sense to invest so much money in hardware, software and training if you then don't make sure you've raised your standards of literacy, numeracy, etc. Now, if I look at our education policy and at the division between the junior lyceum and the area secondary schools, and at the type of policies that allow nearly half of our students not to be eligible for further education or to leave school without basic certification, it's quite obvious that there's no point in even investing in IT for these kids if we don't also invest in making sure that they can read and write and count, etc., etc., etc. It doesn't make sense, which is one of the problems of having our IT policy determined only by someone who is in industry and not in education. Of course, being in education doesn't mean you actually can see that this is a problem, because we have had numerous ministers, I won't mention anyone in particular, not to have a libel case, and who have not tackled this issue. But it's worth mentioning here, if we want the 75% ECDL that the Minister of MIIT wants, we're not going to get it if we don't have a 75% literacy and numeracy. We can't get it because you can't even do that without that. You know, it's no good. It doesn't make sense. To say nothing of the fact that in the schools at the moment, for computer studies, the lab availability is 50 in the state schools. I have to point out that I have not done any work on church and independent schools yet. And this is something that I do need to do, especially since the church schools are getting very good results in computer studies, much better than you would think by their population. In other words, they have a higher pass rate, take-up and pass rate, than the other schools, even more than their proportion of the Form 5 population. So one would like to see why they are so successful. And I have some ideas, but I still have to check them out. Going back to the state schools, 50 places are available per form. So only 50 of those students in Form 3, Form 4 and Form 5 can take up computer studies, not IT, because ICT, through the European Computer Driving License, is now going to be available to every single state school student, one lesson a week for the whole 5 years. So let's go back to computer studies. 50 students on the criteria of their performance in maths, English and IT. That's the first thing. Of course, competing for lab space with the ECDL classes and with any other teacher who wants to use the computer lab for ICT across the curriculum, which is something as the division would like to see, but admits they don't have enough labs. One teacher told me a very good idea, if the minister is listening to this, that given that the price of laptops has gone down so much, and given that we had invested in laptops for all primary teachers, when we have evidence that they're not actually using them very much, why don't we provide laptops for all secondary school teachers, monitors, and the teachers can then use them in normal classrooms for ICT across the curriculum? I think that's quite a good suggestion. At 300 Malta pounds ago, maybe at some time we could do it. But two apart from that, the ECDL, we're saying that this is looks like a very equitable program, and it is certainly proposed as one that is going to give access, and compared to other countries, I think that it is very brave and equitable. Every student, one lesson a week. However, what does the one lesson a week mean? It means that each student sitting by pair, two by two, at the monitor and then switching will have maximum 15 minutes a week. Now, there is no way that with 15 minutes a week, even if it is for 5 years, you can get all the modules of ECDL. This is what teachers tell you. So most young people are getting private tuition or working on their own. They can work on their own with the ECDL because you can have help, get a handbook and also online. If you have the intellectual capacity, and if you have already been prepared, for example, in English. But if you don't, you can't do it. So this is a problem. Having said that, I think that the division is definitely trying to do its best. For example, it's running a conversion course for those pupils who in the past few years were not doing the ECDL but other IT, basic ICT, and now want to do the ECDL. And the conversion course is running in the summer and after school hours. So it is certainly trying its best to give access to as many pupils as possible. And of course, amongst these, there will be girls. Regarding the digital divide, there is still a gender digital divide. If not only that, it seems to have increased. That is, initially, when we have data for SEC from 1994, there was practically a 50% females, 50% males, and now that has gone down to only 37% of all those sitting for SEC being females, and much more amongst males. However, the thing that is most worrying is the difference across school types, and it suggests to me that the digital divide is more to do with social class, which of course is not surprising, because Data from the household information indicator showed us that lower income groups have far less access to PCs and to internet. An incredible difference. For example, only 14% of the very low income groups compared to 67% of the high income groups have access to internet. So if you don't have access at home, and then if the school is only giving you 15 minutes a week, it's obvious that you can't do very much here. So unless we tackle the question of social exclusion there, which the Ministry of IIT is trying to do, it says, by making the hardware cheaper in the deals with HP, the software cheaper in the deal with Microsoft, the training cheaper in the deals with Oracle, etc. However, I mean, I don't know what the minister thinks. Someone who earns £2,000 minimum wage, social assistance, as many of these families are, poverty line, a £300 computer, even if you're only paying £5 a month, is often beyond the means of most of these families. The broadband connection is still high, £14 a month. So you could be paying £5 a month for your computer, another £14 for your broadband connection, and then, you know, it's £20 a month. And really, it's moving away from the idea that education, state education, is the place where people learn. It is provided for free because it is a public good. It's the discourse have shifted to the private sector. The private sector sorts out our social exclusion problems. And for many of us, this isn't really the way to do it. We would prefer to see a good education policy where education is recognized as a public good because every citizen has a right to it, and the community has a right to educate its citizens. And we would prefer to see an IT policy which is more aware of what is happening in the schools. I think I'll leave it there so that we can get some comments on air and then go off air in about 10 minutes time perhaps. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks Dr. Dalmani.
I have to use this now.
Yes.
Thanks, Dr. Dalmani, for a very revealing exposition. And you've raised lots of questions. Just a point of information before I open up for questions. Mention was made of NIFTE, Light Institute for Further Technical Education. That was introduced in the late 90s, between 97 and 98, one of those years, through Israeli influence, through ORT. And it was meant to be a public good. In fact, it was introduced by the ETC at the time for free. The idea was that somebody could be, I don't know, an academic teaching humanities and wants to take up, you know, a particular trade, or somebody's working in a particular field and wants to just learn. And industry was supposed to open its doors for these people. In fact, ST Microelectronics were amongst the first to do this for free. Now you've got to pay. So now you've got to pay for it. So there's been a big shift in policy there. And also the NSIT, the 1993, many of us here at the university were involved in certain segments of it. So there was a lot of very strong university input into that one. Okay. So any questions or statements or comments?
Yeah.
Okay.
Give the microphone.
Yes, yeah.
Will you identify yourself?
Yes, I will. Thank you. Dr. Christopher Staff from the Department of Computer Science and Artificial Department here at the University of Malta. I mean, that's a good point, Dr. Mayo, about how much university involvement there had been in the National Strategy for IT back in 93-94. Unfortunately, the same can't be said for the current government strategy with IT, where I think it's fair to say university has practically been ignored, even though we have offered many, many times to provide input into the government's current strategy. Perhaps we'll be given opportunity before things become too set in stone. I would like to point out a couple of things that Dr. Dharmanin raised. You mentioned earlier in your talk about the survey that had been conducted on private training centres.
Yes.
Saying that there was a high involvement from the under 20s and many of them learning IT.
Yes.
Government's current strategy is to move a lot of that training out of the private training centres and into places like university and MCAST, focusing almost exclusively on things like Cisco training, Oracle training, and Microsoft training, which unfortunately means that private industry is losing a source of revenue from providing that training in the first place, but also meaning that there is ever-increasing pressure to incorporate commercial certification courses into what's effectively state-provided education, like a degree from the University of Malta. There is considerable pressure to incorporate some of these courses into the IT degree, for instance. I personally don't see why, although I think it's been good the government has been able to broker these deals to reduce the cost of training to people who need it, I don't see why we have to stop at just the five or seven companies that government has identified, especially when not one of those companies is an open source company. There is a lot of training which is available in areas for Linux, for instance, which the operating system is free to use. You might still need to have a financial assistance to buy hardware to run it on, but they will run on ordinary cheap computers now, and they will run on Intel chips. Excuse me. It also means that there's less reliance on particular suppliers of IT technology, which, you know, tomorrow some disaster might occur and then suddenly the likes of Microsoft might not be able to provide the levels of support that they've been providing currently. Another point is, which is also worrying me, I'm a Macintosh user. I have brought my personal Mac laptop with me, punching away at the keyboard. The deal, for instance, that government has struck with Microsoft, where you can get reduced cost Microsoft Office for Windows machines, I'm still waiting to hear about the the cheap license for Microsoft Office running on an Apple Macintosh. I don't see why we should be forced into particular hardware and software technologies if the aim is to raise the involvement of people with IT in general. It should be looking at ways of doing it across the board rather than locking people into particular strategies and technologies. Thank you.
Do we want to get more before I comment? Or?
No, go ahead.
Thank you, Chris. That was very, very helpful. And yes, I mean, you understand the field more at the university level. I think that your concerns about, well, the move away from the local private companies, which have invested a lot, are a source of employment, to another form of privatization, because of course when the university does a deal with a private company, let's not make a mistake, this is a still a private company in the so-called private public partnership. Actually what it means is that you are favoring and therefore creating an unfair, if one could think of it like that, an unfair competitive framework, apart from the fact that you are, as you pointed out very well, limiting very much your clients to using specific companies for training. You're creating imbalances in the field of the services, and you're maybe doing even the opposite of what you really want to do, because one of the declarations is to make Malta more competitive, and actually this is reducing competition in every sense. Your other point on the academic curriculum and the influence of these companies on that, I think is something that certainly should concern us very much. Of course, a good academic curriculum would prepare anyone to, if they wanted to, also learn how to use the other databases, etc., as with Oracle, but it wouldn't limit the academic curriculum to that. The academic curriculum is much more academic freedom, if we still value it, I sometimes wonder, is also much more than that. We should have the tools to be able to critique or to study the software, the hardware, the whole thing, the whole setup. And the other concern, the transnational corporations, they move where they find better places. If we don't satisfy their ultimate requirements, which we don't even know what they are, because we haven't seen the agreements, with the excuse that these are commercial agreements. So again, that is something that would worry me, that the university, instead of entering into an academic agreement where one could have a look at the fine print, would enter into a commercial agreement where you couldn't have a look at it. These are all very major concerns, I think. And I do think that in the long term, it will create problems for Malta and IT. In the short term, we might have a group of young graduates, or not even graduates, because if they don't need graduates, they won't encourage people to be graduates. And that is one of the things. They'll just encourage them to be trained rather than educated. And that's a distinction we need to make. We will have people, and if they provide us with a market for services, then they'll find jobs. If they don't, or if they decide to go elsewhere because the cost of labour in Malta is rising so much, these people will be trained, but there won't be the jobs for them. So that's another concern that I think we need to look at. So in the long term, I I'm not a free marketeer, but I do agree that once we have a market, we should at least have fair competition. We should not have monopolies in such a small situation. And we should have an independent education policy community and an educated public sphere, which we don't have.
Do you want to ask a question? I have a comment to that.
Okay.
No, I'm not an economist, but I'm right now. I happen to be teaching a course. I'm finishing a course on. I mentioned this last time on adult education in small states. And one of the issues we're dealing with is the impact of globalization on microstates. Now, last time in our speech, we mentioned about the impact on xenophobia. But one of the issues I've come across, and I also have corresponded with a well-known political economist on this internationally, is that, and this is what could be influencing policy, because ICT is very much on the agenda of the European Union. Mary's seen my paper on lifelong learning, how it runs through.
Yes, the Learning Society.
It's the Learning Society, it's basically an ICT.
Castells was one of the main authors in
the Information Age,
the Information Age.
It's all true, it's all ICT and vocationalism. ICT, vocationalism. Yeah. I've just come aboard and I've done a critique of this. But there's another dimension. From what I can understand from this literature on small states and this discussion I've had with Professor Kazim Bakus, who's done a lot of work on this through email correspondence, is the issue of outsourcing.
Yeah.
Under the situation of what I call the intensification of globalization, because globalization is not something which appeared now. Capitalism has always been global and always had a globalizing influence. But the whole issue of outsourcing makes it very difficult for small states to attract manufacturing industry.
Yeah.
Because manufacturing industry needs a large labor force, and small states cannot provide that. So there's a lot of pressure on small states to go for outsourcing in high-tech fields where they don't need a large labor force. This is what's coming out across from the literature. Now, that does not necessarily mean ICT. I mean, that's the point that you were making earlier on. It doesn't mean that. But I wonder if this dimension is also influencing this kind of thinking?
Well, our problem here, I think, is going to be the opposite, in the sense that the Maltese companies are going to outsource a lot of their work. For example, even in IT, like Air Malta has just announced, that work that was previously done here, they're going to do elsewhere. And it will be exactly in these fields because you can do it, because you can do it because of telephony or internet. So we're going to train people to do this work, but actually the jobs are going to be in India, you know. I don't actually know what we are training them for, except our own e-government, which, as I said earlier, our e-government is going to promote certain supposed services, like getting your birth certificate on the internet, which aren't the types of services most people will need.
My feeling is that the micro-state dimension,
yes,
and all the literature, that it has never been actually... So I put this question, I said, I wonder if that's influencing, because it should. But my feeling is that this dimension is not taken into consideration.
Can I just make another comment? I of course agree with you that we must consider the particularities, and that's why I spoke about our context of being a microstate, and the being specifically in our glocal, what it means for us to be in this type of glocal. However, I must say, and I agree here with one researcher, you sent me this reference, Peter, where on the world divided in two, and the digital divide, and looking at it from a global perspective. Whether we are a microstate or not a microstate, the new economy is not going to offer any hope for long-standing or permanent jobs that would create, the author says, stability or social security in young people's lives. It will be the same wherever they are. In the weightless economy, all right, of the future, young people in the north work primarily in flexible, half-time, half-pay service sector jobs, while the youth of the south slave away in sweatshops. Neither of them are going to have a good deal. Mm. All right, this is how it's going to be. So let's not kid ourselves. I mean, probably the ones of the north will be better off. However, they're not going to be in some very good situation, even with these jobs. And in fact, this article and a number of others ask the question, you know, we are going to have these skills, but then if you look at the content of what we are using the skills for, we have to ask that. I mean, when people like Castells promote, is a sort of very optimistic, and not only Castells, Rodriguez, etc., about the learning society, they don't ask the big questions like this information that we are exchanging. What is it really going to give us? What are we going to learn? How is it actually going to make our lives better? Is it actually the case? Because even if we look at just this question of the e-services, at the same time that you can do certain things on the internet, then you can't get basic healthcare anymore, you can't get social security anymore, you can't get housing anymore, because you're running down the welfare state. So, you know, I don't want to just be a tourist who can find out where Valletta is on some type of screen in a piazza, if then there's no bus to get there. I mean, it's as basic as that.
But this is probably also a problem inherent in government policies anywhere, which push IT as a panacea or a solution to all ills. Because we would regard the development of IT as a necessary tool,
yes,
for learning.
Oh, yes.
And we would regard the higher branches of IT as having a logic of its own, which expands learning. But insofar as government treats basic IT as a panacea, it's avoiding critical education.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Because the whole discourse of IT, the whole discourse of IT as a solution to our economic problems or anybody's economic problems,
or
really
our education
acts
problems
in conjunction with those who want to downplay education.
Yes.
At least at university level. Because university education is all about developing critical minds and critical faculties.
Yeah. Yes, and also when you talk about a digital divide, you're forgetting that there's a divide about everything, obviously, and you don't talk about it. And what's more, they actually call it the so-called digital divide in their, in these policy texts, and even in comments at the seminar I mentioned earlier, the so-called, well, it isn't so-called, it is a divide, but it is also a divide in every other sphere. So let's not think that our only divide is digital. We might well, you know, manage to do something about some aspect of the digital divide, like with mobile phones. I've no doubt that's not going to be a divide anymore. We recently in the paper, there was, you know, in Africa, I don't know where, someone has a mobile phone. Well, I'm not surprised they don't have a telephone. So at least if you have a mobile phone, you know, however, they still don't have, you know, sanitation, water, electricity, etc., etc.
May I ask a much simpler question? I'd like to. You've raised so many interesting issues in your paper, but I want to ask a very simple question, which takes off from points made by Chris Staff. And my very simple question is this: do I take it from what you've said that one of the main purposes of the government Microsoft agreement that was publicly expressed was to promote IT education in Malta? Is that part of your point?
To make IT accessible by making software affordable. And I would think that if a lot of students are buying the affordable software, and a lot of teachers and certain groups like persons with a disability are meant to be able to get it for free, then there's going to be more pressure put on the Ministry of Education to actually teach and educate people to the ECDE. ADL 75% of the minister would like to see. If 75% of school leavers do get the ECDL, of course it is a great achievement. There's no denying it. You made that point, Paul Chris. We would all like to see no exclusion and better educated people. But we do also have to ask, for what are they going to be educated? What will they be able to do once they get that? And also, is it really the case that we will get those types of percentages if we don't also take into account the other problems in education policy?
Thank you. I mean, that was the, it's just a very basic question of information that I was asking, and you've partially answered it. Did the agreement also include provisions whereby Microsoft undertook to finance?
Yes.
Basic technological, not just to make the equipment more affordable,
but also to provide
education in this technology at primary or secondary level?
They do software, Microsoft, and they're providing the software at a greatly reduced price.
We haven't seen
the text. I tried to get it, actually. I tried to get it through the Microsoft website, and it's impossible to get. You know, you can't get it. Yes, okay. You can't get it. And I tried other ways. You can't get it, basically. Okay, yeah.